Hey there, welcome to LiveWire. I'm Luke Burbank. We have got a very special holiday episode of the show for you this week, and it wouldn't be the holidays around here without a visit from Paul F. Tompkins, the comedian and actor. He will finally weigh in on the topic of passive-aggressive Christmas carolers at a Scottish-themed steakhouse in Los Angeles. It's what you've been waiting for, I know. Also, he's going to talk about how he and his wife Janie discovered the term weekend water. We're also going to talk to Sarah Marshall, host of the wildly popular podcast You're Wrong About, on why a lot of us, myself included, tend to sort of get it so wrong when it comes to how we remember big news stories and events. That might be handy to brush up on before all those holiday dinner conversations. Then we're going to hear some new music from LiveWire favorite Jimmy Harrod. That is the plan. We're spreading tidings of comfort and jokes this week on the show, starting right after this. This episode of LiveWire is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you can call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law. Hey, Elena.
Hey, Luke. How's it going?
Good. The holidays are here, and it is time for, I consider this a somewhat holiday-related station location identification examination.
Ooh.
Yes, right? Okay, this is where I'm going to tell you about a place in the country where we're on the radio. You got to try to guess where I am talking about. This city is home to the historic annual Grandma's Marathon, which is not actually a marathon for grandmas, but is named after Grandma's Restaurant. It's one of the largest and best-known marathons in America. It's got over 20,000 participants.
Ah, I don't know. I mean, there's grandmas all over this country. It's one of the things that makes it great. I mean, marathoning, is it a certain time of year?
It doesn't say on my list here. I'm guessing not in the winter, because I'll give you another hint. This is a place where it is very, very snowy around the holidays. In fact, thousands of people flock to this city during Christmas time to see Bentleyville, the largest walk-through display of lights in America. There's also a Christmas village and the historic Glen Sheen Mansion, which has over 25 Christmas trees in it.
I still don't know, but a snowy place that I love is, let's say, in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan.
Man, you're so close. I'm just winging it with this hint. But did you know Telly Savalas recorded a series of ads for this city to promote it? This is a real thing.
Is it Duluth, Minnesota?
It's Duluth, Minnesota. Why was that the hint that worked for you? They're amazing, by the way. Telly Savalas doing ads for Duluth is something you just can't unhear once you've heard them. Where we're on the radio on WSCN out there in Duluth. So thank you so much to all of those folks for tuning in. Should we get to the show?
Let's do it.
Take it away.
From PRX, it's LiveWire! This week, comedian Paul F. Tompkins.
I like to sing, but I don't want to be on somebody's front doorstep. Love Actually style. I mean, I would show up and turn the cards over, for sure. I would do that.
And podcaster Sarah Marshall.
I would always find little backdoor ways to cram a story about some kind of 80s media fiasco into a TV review.
With music from Jimmy Harrod and our fabulous house band. I'm your announcer, Elena Passarello, and now, the host of LiveWire, Luke Burbank!
Hey, thank you so much, Elena. Thanks to everyone for tuning in from all over the country. This is a special holiday edition of LiveWire, and as such, we've asked the listeners a special holiday question. What is your favorite holiday tradition? We're going to hear those responses coming up in just a few minutes. In the meantime, Elena, I'm curious, what is your favorite holiday tradition?
Back when I was a youngin, we would always get into the car and drive just a couple hours to my grandma's place in North Carolina and have like a noon Christmas meal. But she lived in a pretty small house, and so we would drive home. She made this gigantic Southern, you know, like butter beans and like two kinds of meat and biscuits galore. It was like a week's worth of calories, and we ate it, and we always were like, we're never going to eat again. And so then we'd drive home, and we would invariably get strangely hungry at like 7:30 p.m., and there would be nothing in the fridge. Right. So I don't know how to cook. I still don't know how to cook. But the only thing that I was confident, because I was like a college student, a high school student, was making nachos. So for years, our Christmas dinner, like while we were watching It's a Wonderful Life or whatever, was Christmas nachos. And it was kind of special because it was literally the only time that I ever made food for my mother and stepfather.
And was it just sort of, I mean, regular nachos? Like you didn't bring home a bunch of leftovers and like integrate them into the nachos or anything?
No. Now that I live with a kind of a good gourmand, we do take those kinds of nacho liberties.
Adventures.
But it was just like, oh, there's a can of green chilies in the pantry and some tortilla chips and some shredded cheese. And, you know, I never go anywhere without having chips and salsa close by. But, you know, we've continued the tradition. Like I said, now I live with David, who can make a heck of a holiday meal, but we still always make space at one point during the Christmas Eve, Christmas Day, whatever, to eat a plate of Christmas nachos. Like, it's just not Christmas without them.
The colors also work.
You
get the red salsa, you get the green of some chilies. I mean, it's honestly, I can't believe more people aren't making Christmas nachos, Elena.
Well, maybe this will start the tradition now.
All right, If you try some Christmas nachos this year and you enjoy them, email us. Let us know how it went for you. I would say that one of my favorite holiday traditions is kind of related to the fact that I grew up in a sort of odd Christmas environment. My parents, we didn't really celebrate Christmas when I was a young kid because of the church my parents went to and stuff. But over time, we had stockings, and then we would put some presents in there. And then there was a sort of growing sense of Christmas in my house. And so I remember one year when, I don't even know if we had a tree yet, but I know that it was like we were allowed to give each other presents and go buy presents and stuff like that. And this, I think, was like my first year. I'm probably like, I don't know, 10, 11 years old. My first year where I'm going to Craigen's Pharmacy in Seattle and spending all my allowance to get amazing gifts. Like, I got my dad a laminated sign that said, "To error is human. To really screw things up, you need a computer." And it just had like a total like 1980s computer that was spewing paper out of the printer. It was
like, sounds like a Garfield joke.
Totally. It was like, these were the worst presents. But I remember sitting in my bedroom and listening to the radio while I was wrapping these presents, and this is Christmas Eve, and I was just so excited to get to like be part of having presents and giving presents and all that stuff. And they happened to be playing this old time version of A Christmas Carol, like an old radio production of A Christmas Carol. And like, you know, when you're a kid, sometimes you'll do something weird where you'll just like sit kind of crisscross applesauce in an uncomfortable fashion for no discernible reason and then make a goal for yourself. My goal was I had to wrap all the presents before I was allowed to sit in a more comfortable position.
What?
I don't know why. I just remember sitting on the floor in my bedroom, listening to A Christmas Carol and sitting and wrapping presents. And to this day, when it is time for me to wrap presents, it is Christmas Eve. I have found that same recording. It has Lionel Barrymore in it playing Mr. Scrooge. I play it now. It's from the internet, of course. But I play that. I sit on the floor. I don't sit on a chair like a normal person. I sit on the floor and I wrap presents. To this day, I'm 46 years old.
Well, you know, if you ever want to switch it up, you can also go on the internet and look up the Yinzer Christmas Carol, which is...
like, as in from Pittsburgh?
Yeah, it's these two comedians that are called Greg and Donnie, and they do, like, instead of saying bah humbugs, Scrooge says, oh, bull crap. And he's like, and the boy, it's like, boy, what day is it? Get out of Giant Eagle. Give me the biggest turkey you can find.
I love, like, head down to Primanti's.
Get me the biggest
sandwich you can find.
It's very good.
Say there, boy, are the Steelers still in the playoffs?
Yeah. Are you being nebby with me, Mr. Ghost? I don't think so.
I would absolutely listen. In fact, you know what? Maybe that can be, I can add that. I'll wrap some of the presents the night before Christmas Eve, and I'll listen to the Yinzer Christmas Carol.
Or just get into a cross-legged position and eat Christmas nachos.
I'm not kidding you. Maybe I'm just too hungry when we tend to record the show, but Christmas nachos sound incredible to me right now. I would crawl across broken Christmas ornaments to get my hands on some Christmas nachos. That's how hungry I am. I could be like Bruce Willis in Die Hard, getting to the Christmas nachos. Anyway, we're going to read the listener responses to their favorite holiday traditions coming up. In the meantime, though, we've got to welcome our first guest on over to the show. Now, if you're looking for comedy and podcast royalty, this guy definitely qualifies. He plays Mr. Peanut Butter on BoJack Horseman. He was on HBO's Mr. Show. He's appeared on hundreds of episodes of Comedy Bang Bang. Take a listen to our conversation with Paul F. Tompkins, recorded in front of a live audience at Revolution Hall in Portland, Oregon.
Hi! Hello!
Welcome to the show, Paul.
Thanks for having me back, guys. It's a pleasure to see you again.
Yay! It's been a long time coming. We've been trying to get you back up here for like a year and a half, and you wouldn't come.
Yeah, I took a year off last year, and I said, I'm going to really take some time to sit and think.
At the beginning of the pandemic, I know you and your wife, the actor Janie Haddad Tompkins, started doing this podcast, Stay F. Homekins.
Yes, that's correct.
There's a lot of Haddad Tompkins heads here. That's what
Absolutely.
That cheer was.
Absolutely, the Hadheads, yes.
Hadheads.
And this show has actually become really popular. It made a lot of kind of best of the year lists. It's a delight.
First of all, I wouldn't say it's become really popular. I would say we were surprised that anyone listened to it. By that measure, yes, it's astoundingly popular.
I feel like this podcast should be in the Stay F. Homekins podcast, should be in the podcasting Hall of Fame for just one thing, which is popularizing a term that you and Janie engage in as you're recording the show. So the sort of conceit of the show is it's an after-dinner chat. Mm. You're just kind of talking about the world and your lives and everything, and you're enjoying a little... A weekend water.
That's correct.
What's the story on weekend water?
This was a phrase that was coined by Janie's mother, who lives in South Carolina. And one of her grandchildren was making a move to pick up one of her drinks. I think this was at 4th of July. And she said, oh, no, honey, don't touch that. That's grandma's weekend water. And I never forgot it.
I feel like that could really revolutionize someone's relationship with drinking. Mm-hmm. Maybe not even for the best. Because mm-hmm.
Definitely not for the best.
If it's Tuesday, so it's, are you having a drink? It's like 4 on Tuesday. You're like, I'm just having a little weekend water. Yeah. Really kind of takes the judgment off of it.
Yeah.
Then it just becomes a matter of semantics.
Yes, yeah. Indeed. I was wondering if hosting this podcast with your wife has been good for the relationship, bad for the relationship? Have things remained unchanged?
It's been good for the relationship, I think. It was a very weird thing. We'd never done anything like that before, and together. We'd never done a podcast together before. So it was like, well, this is my personal relationship with my wife. I don't know if I want to share it. And then it was fun. Like the first time we did it, it was fun. And I was like, I guess we're doing this for as long as we are stuck here inside. And then after things lifted, it just seemed like, let's keep doing it. But we couldn't do it with the same regularity because things started to, we started to work again. And, you know, but I think we're going to keep doing it once a month. It's just, it's become its own thing at this point. And we have merch, so we got to sell it.
Yeah.
Once merch enters a marriage, there's no turning back.
I think it was the most recent episode where you were expressing a certain amount of concern for Adele. You feel like she is singing in some kind of new accent.
You know,
what is your evidence?
Okay. We were right before we started recording, we were listening to Adele's new album, and there's this style of singing that I think, I don't know if it's pushed on young women, like they have to do this if they want to have a hit, or if like young women are just like, oh, that's how people sing now, so I'll just do that. But I call it the Cajun baby singing voice. Because it's very like, it's sort of like a, I'm sort of a child, but now I say toin instead of turn. Like, that's not like a singing accent you can just have. Like, to just sound like a little baby Dr. John.
It's all basically David Sedaris singing the Oscar Mayer theme song as Billie Holiday.
I wish I was an Oscar Mayer wiener. You've nailed it. That's exactly what it is.
Well, that's a thing that David Sedaris really does. I wish I could take credit for it. I'm just reporting the facts of the world.
Yeah.
Oh, and he sings it in the style of Billie Holiday.
Yes. Yeah. Like a sort
that's
of a...
exactly what it is.
Speaking of singing, I know that you are a fan of the Tam O'Shanter in Los Angeles, the Scottish Steakhouse.
Not the hat.
Well,
I wouldn't put
I'm
it past
you. I'm also a fan
you.
Of the hat. I wouldn't put it past you. I wouldn't put it past you. Wear one of those hats.
Do you own one?
Of course I do. Of course I do.
Hold on, Paul. You know what? We need to take a quick break. When we come back, I want to ask you about the live caroling at the Tam O'Shanter.
Sure. What a cliffhanger, guys.
This is Livewire. We're talking to Paul F. Tompkins. Back with more in just a moment.
Vacations, weddings, birthdays, and reunions. Oh my, there's so much going on. Get the most out of your spring plans by stocking up on pre-alcohol now. ZBiotics pre-alcohol probiotic drink is the world's first genetically engineered probiotic. It was invented by PhD scientists to tackle rough mornings after drinking. Here's how it works. When you drink, alcohol gets converted into a toxic byproduct in the gut. It's this byproduct, not dehydration, that's to blame for your rough next day. ZBiotics produces an enzyme to break this byproduct down. Just remember to make ZBiotics your first drink of the night, drink responsibly, and you'll feel your best tomorrow. Go to ZBiotics.com/LiveWire to get 15% off your first order when you use LiveWire at checkout. ZBiotics is backed with 100% money-back guarantee, so if you're unsatisfied for any reason, they'll refund your money, no questions asked. Remember to head to ZBiotics.com/LiveWire and use the code LiveWire at checkout for 15% off. Thank you to ZBiotics for sponsoring this episode and our good times.
Welcome back to LiveWire from PRX, coming to you from Revolution Hall in Portland, Oregon. I'm Luke Burbank here with Elena Passarello. We're talking to Paul F. Tompkins from Threedom and BoJack Horseman and Mr. Show and so many other amazing fun places and the Tam O'Shanter, Los Angeles' leading Scottish steakhouse, where they feature live Christmas carolers.
Yes.
What's your relationship with that form of entertainment?
Well, with that form of entertainment, I think it was a thing. Caroling, I think, was always a thing I was scared would show up at my door. It was a thing I was afraid I would be invited to do. Neither of those things ever happened.
But you're such a good singer.
Well, don't say that. I'm okay. I do all right. But there's something. There is a weird thing. There's like a certain shyness that you get when you can do a thing, but you're asked to do it in a weird situation. And it's like, I like to sing, but I don't want to be on somebody's front doorstep. Love Actually style. And I mean, I would show up and turn the cards over for sure. I would do that. If you want to print out the words to Good King Wenceslas on a series of cards, I will show up at someone's door and turn them over. This is actually not a bad idea the more I'm thinking about it. But I think it's a bit of whimsy that I think people would enjoy. But so I started going to the Tam O'Shanter, which is one of the oldest restaurants in Hollywood. Walt Disney's animators used to, and I think still do. I think the Disney animators still, out of tradition, go there to get drunk. A thing that I did not know the first time I went there with a friend of mine during the Christmas season, we were just going to meet up for a dinner and catch up, that they have strolling Victorian carolers that walk throughout the restaurant. And they come up to you and they ask you what song you want to hear, and you have to tell them the name of a song that you want to hear. And then they sing it at you.
Hello from the Other Side.
Has to be a Christmas song.
Oh.
Although I've never tested that out.
You can change it to like Hello from the Yule Tide.
Absolutely. So the first year that happened, we were like, that was weird. So the next year, we were like, how do we prevent that from happening again? And so we said, all right, we'll devise a plan. I don't think we can make them stop. So we'll figure out where to look. And so it won't be as uncomfortable. So what I did was, afterwards we compared notes, and I said, where did you look? And he said, I just looked at in the eyes of the ladies. I just did that. And I said, I looked sort of in the middle distance and nodded my head as if I was really into it. Like it was really powerful to me. So then the thing is, we kept forgetting that this was going to happen. And we had a yearly engagement. After Thanksgiving, we would go to the Tam O'Shanter and have dinner. So then the next year, we're prepared for it. And we say, all right, here's what we'll do. We'll tell them, oh, you already sang the one that we wanted to hear. We just heard you sing it at this other table. Well, guess what? You could tell from the reaction, they had heard this before. It got so passive aggressive. And they were all of them, four of them, in this Victorian garb, were like, oh, okay, all right, great, yeah, no problem, no problem. And they're walking away, and we're like, it was so beautiful. I was like, yeah, uh-huh, yeah, sure, uh-huh. And that felt so bad. So the next year we're like, okay, we're just going to let it happen. And we're, you know, it's like, what? Why are we bothered so much by this? So then that's the year that we're cheerful about it. We're like, yes, we can't wait. Let's hear Oh Holy Night or whatever. Then we witness them getting into a weird fight about the key, because the the guy on the end says, what key is it again? The guy on the other end says it's in C. And so they start looking through the book and like trying to figure out what key is this in? And the guy in the end is like, it's in C, like I said. And then they finally find it in the book and they say, okay. And the guy on the one end says, okay, and it's in C. And the guy in the end says, like I said. And then they sang the tensest Oh Holy Night that I'd ever heard.
You should invite them on your variety show that you've been doing in Los Angeles.
You know what? I should. I absolutely should. I should invite them out of season and get them on there.
Talk about that, because you've gone back to live performing. I'm wondering, like, for the audience, is the audience subdued, or are they just, like, excited to be somewhere? Are the performers, is everyone, I mean, what's the general feeling?
The audience is very subdued. It's not going well. And it's been fantastic. My first show back was in September, and the feeling in the room for everybody on stage, everybody off stage, was just cathartic. Everyone was excited to be somewhere doing something that felt kind of normal. It's a big show. It's got a big band and you know, a lot of guests and everything, and a lot of songs to be learned and things like that. And I'm hoping to ride that feeling for as long as I possibly can.
People can watch this on Vimeo if they're not in Los
Angeles.
That's
right, Luke!
I was wondering, you're a very skilled improviser. You improv all these characters. The irony is, we planned that.
Yeah,
that was not
scripted.
Improvised.
That was scripted months ago.
And he kind of stepped on my line.
I did. I couldn't wait. I got excited.
One job, Tompkins. Did you go to one of these improv programs, like a Second City or Groundlings or IO or something? How did you get started with this? And when did you know, oh, this is something I'm actually kind of have a knack for?
Yeah, it was really, it was osmosis from doing podcasts. Because when I started doing characters, I never had to do that before to sustain a character and to sort of conceit and like a story over the course of that long. And so from doing podcasts and doing them with other people who did that kind of character work regularly, I got to a point where I was like, I think I want to throw myself into the deep end. I think I've learned the precepts of this from being around it and seeing it done so much. And so I started doing like live improv shows. A couple of people asked me to do it, and then I started doing a podcast where I had to improvise every week. And that was a podcast called Spontaneity Nation.
Yes.
Thank you. And that was like, I was like, I'm gonna make it so that I am the weakest link of every show, and if I can be good as the weakest link of the show, then that's what I'm gonna be. I'm gonna get guests on the show who are so good and so skilled at doing this that that's how I'm gonna learn how to do this.
That's amazing to me, because as a Spontaneity Nation listener, I assumed that we were sort of catching up with you in like year 15 of your hardcore improv career.
You sure weren't.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow, that was impressive. You also uttered maybe one of the greatest lines, I believe it was on Spontaneity Nation. I don't know if this was improvised or actually part of you said, I believe it was Benjamin Franklin who said, you've reached the end of your Benjamin Franklin quote of the month.
Luke, can I tell you?
I say that in my head all the time.
That was a scripted line from BoJack Horseman. Mr. Peanut Butter said that.
Oh, no.
So not only did I not come up with it myself, a cartoon dog said it.
Paul F. Tompkins, everybody.
That was Paul F. Tompkins right here on this special holiday edition of Livewire. His stand-up special, Crying and Driving, two of the most common things that I do, sometimes at the same time, is available now, as are his many, many podcasts. And one other exciting update, Elena, did you know Paul is also in Weird, the Al Yankovic story, which came out earlier this year?
Apparently, it's a biography with absolutely no facts in it, which is how I like my biopics, honestly.
That sounds perfect for Al Yankovic's career. Hey, special thanks this episode to Samita Reddy of Portland, Oregon. Samita is part of the Livewire member community and is generously supporting our show with a donation each month, and we are very thankful for that support. It is how we are able to keep this whole thing going. So, a big thanks to Samita. This is Livewire. Of course, each week we ask our listeners a question. This is a holiday show, so we thought we'd ask the listeners, what is your favorite holiday tradition? And Elena has been collecting up those responses. What do you see?
Here's a cute one from Paige. Paige says, one of my fave traditions is eating the pomegranate that is at the toe of my stocking on Christmas morning. Did you have this, Luke, where you always had some kind of fruit in the toe of your stocking?
Not as a kid, but now in adulthood, like with my daughter and stuff, we always throw a couple of those like mandarin oranges or something in there. I didn't know pomegranate was an option, but that seems really fun.
Me either. Yeah, it sounds really good. We had tangerines, but I like the pomegranate. And then you eat it on Christmas morning, according to Paige, in order to make it special. Love it.
A pro tip on that, get some newspaper. Because those pomegranates are messy work.
You'll ruin your stocking. Did you know, by the way, that I use the same Christmas stocking that my mother made me when I was a baby? I still use the same one.
Oh my gosh, that is absolutely adorable. Now, what usually, like, what does David put in there?
We only do stockings. We don't do any other presents. And you can only buy the stuff that goes in the stockings locally on a designated shopping day, usually the 23rd. So it's like weird tchotchkes, books. Sometimes he'll throw like a necklace in there, which I think is cheating. But it's just like whatever we can buy within like an hour and a half during this designated time. So no shopping anxiety, maximum fun.
What's another holiday tradition that one of our listeners loves around the holidays?
This one made me laugh from Emily. Emily says, maybe this doesn't count as a tradition because I only started doing it last year. back. But my roommates and I celebrate Festivus of Seinfeld fame. We have a tiny Festivus pole. We air our grievances at dinner as good-naturedly as possible. And then we wrestle to compete the feats of strength. I came in last place. Well, I hope they continue the tradition and then Emily can maybe rise in the Festivus feats of strength rankings.
I mean, listen, I consider Christmas nachos a tradition for me, and I haven't even made them yet. I just learned about them. So yeah, Emily, it can be a proud tradition that's only existed for 1 year.
One of my favorite things about Christmas is the weird rituals that you end up doing with your longtime friends, you know, because you got the family version and then the friends, things just get so fun and weird and great. And I just love that.
Yes, absolutely. Festivus for the rest of us, I believe they say. Okay, one more holiday tradition before we get to our next guest.
Oh, well, now this is just a tried and true tradition from Olivia. Olivia's tradition is searching for a pickle in the Christmas tree.
Oh, sure. I mean, who didn't grow up with that?
I wonder, like, is it like, do you ever find the pickle? Did someone actually hide a pickle? Or do you just go on this kind of like Quixotian task of like looking for a pickle in the Christmas tree?
And do you eat it when you find it? Like, to what end? Because I'll tell you what, I love me some pickles. And I would probably, if it only been up in the tree for a day or two, I would eat it 100%.
Or is it like an ornament? Everything about this is worthy of investigation, which is how I like my Christmas traditions. So good job, Olivia.
Yes. I love that for them. All right. Thanks, Olivia. Thanks, everyone else who sent in your responses. You are listening to a special holiday episode of LiveWire from PRX. I'm Luke Burbank. That's Elena Passarello over there. Now, the holidays for a lot of us mean sitting around a table, maybe taking a trip down memory lane with your family. And sometimes you discover that things are not always quite how you remembered them or how somebody else might have remembered them. Our next guest has a lot of thoughts on this. She is a writer, a media critic, and host of the very popular modern history podcast called You're Wrong About, which re-examines news events that a lot of us misunderstood or misremember. The show has explored everything from satanic panic to if Yoko Ono really actually broke up the Beatles. Time magazine called it one of the best podcasts of the year when it first came out, and it continues to get rave reviews and lots of downloads. Take a listen to our conversation with Sarah Marshall, which we recorded in front of a live audience at Revolution Hall in Portland, Oregon.
Sarah, welcome to the show. The kind of premise of You're Wrong About is that there are all of these big news events and things that we've all heard about, but are often wrong about the details of maybe who was at fault or what was really going on. I'm curious why it is you think that we get so much stuff wrong when there is so much information now to be had. We can Google anything and find it out, and yet we're often wrong about things.
We sure are. I feel like this show had a more hard-to-sell premise 2 years ago, because it was like, it's funny. It's almost like the more available the correct information is, the harder it is for us to assimilate that. It's very strange, but it really happens a lot. And now it's like, uh-huh. But I think after looking at as many stories as the show has and seeing how they correlate, I think a couple of the things that turn up a lot is that we tend to believe what we hear first, and then the truth takes longer to come out, and then makes less of an impression, because we're like, I already have an impression. I don't need another impression. I'm fine. And that, you know, things that feel true tend to be what we believe, and then what feels true to us is based on who we are.
Were you, as a journalist, looking at this before you had the podcast, and were you sort of fascinated with that? What were you writing about? What was your relationship with going back and trying to more or less correct how people understood history before the podcast?
At the start of making the podcast, I felt like I had this gigantic backlog of stories that outlets I was trying to pitch freelance stories to weren't really that interested in hearing about. And I'd be like, Amy Fisher. And they'd be like, what, did she do something recently? I'd just be like, no, but there's like people today that don't know the Amy Fisher story, and it's really interesting. And the way the reporting on it completely missed the point at the time, and that's worth reflecting on. Mm-hmm. And so I feel like I would always find little backdoor ways to cram a story about some kind of 80s media fiasco into a TV review. and then eventually it just took over.
I also read that early on, your interest in reporting out this kind of stuff was really kind of coming from a sort of a feminist approach, mm-hmm. particularly the ways that often women are misunderstood, misdescribed, mischaracterized, and you wanted to go in and kind of correct the record on that stuff?
Yeah, and I think the way I see myself getting started on this track is as an Oregonian growing up in the shadow of Tonya Harding, and knowing that that was a story that at first had brought national media to the Portland area in a way that we were like, was pretty new to us at the time. And then looking back not that long after the fact and thinking, gee, it's funny that this story that, if you think about it, is really a tragedy got to be a comedy. Mm-hmm. And then thinking about how many other stories are like that. And often the ones about young women are like that.
Now, writing about that and talking about it into a microphone are kind of two different things. Did you feel immediately comfortable and natural doing it, doing the podcast version? Because this podcast was kind of an immediate hit. Like, did you feel comfortable doing it kind of right away?
It was a learning curve. I think the thing about writing is that you can get it exactly the way you want to get it before mm-hmm. you're releasing it to the world. At least theoretically. And so I think there was something kind of emotional and imprecise about working in a conversational show format that first felt uncomfortable to me, and I now realize is one of the great strengths of the medium and that I really appreciate, is that if I'm telling you about somebody and if I'm getting emotional about it, then that's not a flaw to my analytical approach as it would be if right. I were in academia still. You have to kind of give up on making it an analog for the thing you know to embrace the strengths it has.
Mm-hmm. We're talking to Sarah Marshall, host of the You're Wrong About podcast. One of the things that you have the benefit of doing this show is hindsight. So you can look back on a story like the OJ mm-hmm. trial or, I grew up going to Mike Warnke shows.
Oh,
like
my
gosh. I saw him do stand-up comedy. He was this person who you spent a lot of time talking about who kind of helped create this satanic panic because he had all these wild stories of his time in Satanism, which all turned out to be made up.
Right.
But you have the benefit of hindsight. Have you also now developed this muscle enough that in real time, when the news is happening, you can kind of see like, all right, these are the parts of this story that we're all going to be, or maybe not all of us, but that are going to get misconstrued?
I feel like sometimes I have that, but I also think that the kinds of misconstruals we have now are so extreme that like anyone can do that. It's like having a superpower that lets you punch right through aluminum foil. I'm sad that that was so funny.
So you can see it, but you feel like it doesn't take extreme insight to see how these things are being already sort of going off the rails informationally.
I think a lot of the time, I think we're living in a great age of misinformation. Like, misinformation clearly has always been a force that organizes society, but I think now it's moving faster and there's more of it. So it's like there have always been killer bees, but what if there were like way more killer bees moving faster all around the world? An example that comes to mind is the tragedy at Astroworld, where people were suffocated, killed by essentially the way a human crowd moves if there's over a certain threshold of people in a space that's too small and if the people at the back can't tell what's happening at the front. And so the conspiracy theories that came up were blaming a specific person, saying it was a satanic sacrifice, and also arguing that people were being injected with random drugs, that people were going around injecting people.
I heard that actually from the police department early on. They were pursuing it as a possibility.
Yeah, and that makes sense. And I think, and also one of the consistent problems with the news is that it often reports what the police are speculating and be like, well, that's probably right. And it's like, well, it's probably not. And the idea that if after tragedy caused by human error happens, we want to point a specific finger at someone and possibly call them Satanists. That just seems very consistent over time.
I don't want to be reductive, so forgive me. And I also want to encourage everyone to go download You're Wrong About if you haven't already. But can we run through some topics from the show? And can you kind of just give your kind of first thought from having done the shows, having done the research of what maybe people generally have wrong about it?
Yeah, I love lightning rounds. I'm very excited about
this. Who doesn't? We can take as long as you want.
Okay.
This doesn't have to, there's no...
It's a thunder round.
Yes, exactly. How about Anna Nicole Smith? What's the misperception around her?
Yeah, I think the misperception around her, and so many of these are people that I grew up watching VH1 specials about in the late 90s, is that she was this gold digger who found and preyed upon this incredibly sickly old man and married him for his millions. So, okay. So, in fact, they met when she was a stripper and he courted her for years and years, and she finally agreed to marry him. And then, yes, he died and she fought with his heirs for his money. And he also, before her, had another stripper who he loved and loved buying millions of dollars worth of things for. And that was kind of his pattern. And my argument there is, like, what would you have done if you were her?
Yeah. How about Ebonics or the Ebonics controversy? What were you wrong about with that?
This one is also one I remembered from schoolyard jokes in grade school in the 90s, which is amazing to look back on. And that one basically is based on the fact that I believe one school in one district was talking about, or schools in a single district were talking about teaching basically based on the conceit that you don't automatically correct African-American vernacular English, AAVE, that you recognize that it's a distinct grammar that makes as much sense as any other grammar and then teach using that as a tool. And that got morphed somehow into an incredible number of jokes and inflammatory media and ultimately government doings based on the idea that all children all across America were going to be forced to abandon standard grammar.
So is the critical race theory of its time, basically?
Yeah. I can't tell if it's more or less obviously made up. It's just like a race to the bottom, but yeah.
What about Dr. Oz?
Dr. Oz is a medical wizard and a very honest man. And he can't come back, and he doesn't know how it works. The basic Dr. Oz story is that this actually is kind of a backdoor to the fact that Oprah plays a supporting role in a lot of episodes, if you're wrong about, because she's, you know, because it makes good TV, she's really historically helped a lot of people with wild and eventually proven to be untrue stories to have a gigantic platform. I'm sure everyone out there can think of like three different people. And so the Dr. Oz story is basically that he's promoting as the new wonder cure week after week things with marginal to non-existent health benefits. And it's, you know, I don't know. I think I've got the Wizard of Oz on the brain because I went to Movie Madness for the first time in years and I saw the Wizard of Oz's pants. Everyone go, everyone see the pants. But he's another Wizard of Oz.
Well, speaking of which, you've also got a movie podcast with Alex Stead called You Are Good.
Yeah, Steed.
Steed called You Are Good, which was originally titled Why Are Dads?
Yes.
What was the original concept for the show?
The original premise was, we decided to start a movie podcast kind of in the early days of the pandemic, and the original theme was Apocalypse Friends. Movies about an apocalypse that are also kind of about friendship. So like Dawn of the Dead, which is very much about friendship, as we all know. And and then we realized that was too much of an epic downer, and we decided, okay, dads in movies, because almost everyone has some kind of a relationship to at least one of those things. And we both have idiosyncratic old dads who our relationships with really shaped us as people. And so we started off with what I believe to be mathematically the dadliest movie of all time, which was Jaws.
Really?
Yeah.
What makes it the dadliest movie?
Well, okay, here's my basic thoughts on Jaws. There's, I feel like this is a dream I've had. You've got the scary, angry, Greatest Generation guy, model of masculinity, Robert Shaw, who was traumatized by sharks during World War II, and now is like traumatizing everyone around him as revenge. And then there's the young boomer guy who looks and probably acts exactly like Steven Spielberg, and who's a man of science. And then there's Brody, who's the man of the law and who's a lovely dad to his lovely kids. And between the three of them, they're able to make a beautiful triangle of masculinity that's strong enough to defeat the shark.
You've made an airtight argument as to the dadliness of that film. Yeah. Sarah Marshall, everyone, check out her podcast, You're Wrong About and You Are Good.
That was Sarah Marshall right here on Livewire. I'm Luke Burbank here with Elena Passarella. We have to take a quick break, but don't go anywhere because we will be right back. Livewire is thrilled to be partnering with Portland's own Portal Tea this season. Formerly known as Tea Chai Tay, Portal Tea is the premier tea company in the Pacific Northwest. They make one-of-a-kind, handcrafted tea blends like cinnamon churro chai and blueberry cream Earl Grey. Use the code LIVEWIRE, all lowercase, for 20% off at portaltea.co. Welcome back to LiveWire from PRX. I'm Luke Burbank here with Elena Passarello, special holiday edition of the show. And as such, we've been asking the LiveWire listeners, what is a holiday tradition that you particularly treasure? Elena has been looking at those responses. What are people saying?
This is a really sweet one from Caitlin. Caitlin says, after my uncle died, my family started an annual family monetary donation book in his honor. The four of our families donate money to a cause each year, and we take turns with the book, which is how we remember what we chose, where the money goes each year, and whose turn it is, and things like that. So it sounds like it's this like magical book that gets passed around from family to family, and then you more bang for your buck. All of these different families that were related to this one man, Caitlin's uncle, all kind of come together to make a really sizable donation. Oh, I just love that so much. And then you can read it like a story, you know, as the years go by. It's so beautiful.
Yeah, what a great legacy, too,
for
Caitlin's uncle. That's an amazing way to remember somebody and to do some real good in the spirit of how it sounds like he lived his life. Okay, one more holiday tradition before we get to our next guest.
This one makes me laugh just because of the way that it's worded. This is from Lisa, and Lisa says, every year, my office does an ugly holiday sweater party, and I like that, period.
That's the holiday tradition.
Yeah, it's like, that's the only one, huh, Lisa? And I just like that it's like, full stop. I like the ugly holidays. I can imagine Lisa as that kind of wonderfully upfront colleague.
Lisa's like got the sweater picked out like weeks in advance, just like ready to go ham at the ugly sweater party. You know, everything is so kind of like cyclical. I wonder, are we cycling into a beautiful holiday sweater kind of like era at some point? Like, will we move past the ugly sweater and go to the like tolerable sweater and then eventually to the beautiful sweater?
Like what we thought was ugly in like 2015 all of a sudden becomes fashionable in 2025.
Yes. Every time I think something is out of style, I see somebody wearing it, particularly some young person wearing it, and I realize, oh, that's back in style again.
I never thought about that, but that's true. Like what thing is just going to be ugly no matter what the trends are? And you know what the answer is? The sweater that I'm going to be wearing to the LiveWire holiday party.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. I got a good one. There might be a battery pack involved. Let's just leave it at that.
Oh, I am very excited about this. Our musical guest this week first came to our attention as the Dynamite guest vocalist for Pink Martini, with whom he's performed with around the world, also on LiveWire, not to brag. He's perhaps best known, though, now for his jaw-dropping performance on the 2021 America's Got Talent season, including receiving the coveted Golden Buzzer. Take a listen to Jimmy Harrod performing his song each time in front of a live crowd at LiveWire.
What am I chasing for? What am I chasing for?
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me, Livewire.
That was Jimmy Harrod performing on Livewire his solo album of original works. Falling in Love and Learning to Love Myself is available now. And you can follow Jimmy on Instagram at Jimmy_Harrod. That is Jimmy with an I-E at the end. That's going to do it for this week's episode of Livewire. A huge thanks to our guests, Paul F. Tompkins, Sarah Marshall, and Jimmy Harrod. Livewire is brought to you in part by Alaska Airlines.
Laura Haddon is our executive producer. Heather D. Michelle is our executive director. Our producer and editor is Melanie Sebchenko. Our assistant editor is Trey Hester. Our marketing manager is Paige Thomas. And our production fellow is Tanvi Kumar. Our house band is Ethan Fox Tucker, Sam Tucker, A.L. Alves, and A. Walker Spring, who also composes our music. Molly Pettit is our technical director and mixer, and our house sound is by D. Neil Blake.
Additional funding provided by the Oregon Arts Commission, a state agency funded by the state of Oregon and the National Endowment for the Arts. This week, we'd like to thank member Samita Reddy of Portland, Oregon, who also happens to be a member of Livewire's board. For more information about our show or how you can listen to our podcast, head on over to livewireradio.org. I'm Luke Burbank. For Elena Passarello and the whole Livewire crew, thank you for listening, and we will see you next week. Wouldn't it be amazing to have a piping hot episode of LiveWire delivered right to your heart and ears each week? Well, guess what? That can happen when you subscribe to the LiveWire podcast feed, and you'll get the joy of surprising conversation every week. So go ahead and do it. It's super easy. You click on the button at the top of your podcast app, and bam, you are LiveWire subscribed. And if you're still, you know, feeling the love, if you're enjoying the show, hey, maybe you could hook us up and leave us a quick review. That'll help more people find out about LiveWire. And thank you.